Kia ora, welcome to episode 32 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit John Brown at his home and studio in the Hawke's Bay. Among other qualifications, John holds a Bachelor in Art and Design from AUT and has won the Kaipara Foundation Award in 2012, which is the Swiss Residency Award that he refers to in our conversation, and won the Molly Morpeth Canada Award in 2019. John's is a practice I'm excited to bring your attention to if you haven't seen his work before. I first really started taking notice of his painting only a few years ago, and in that time he's evolved a really strong painting practice both in technical execution and in the representation of subjects, all supported by years of engaging in other practice disciplines. There are images of the paintings that we talk about on the Good Oil John Brown Instagram post for your reference. In the episode, you'll hear John speak about the thorough conceptual approach he takes with a subject before he even picks up a brush, but how that is then, in part at least, abandoned and replaced by the process of painting to create a work. The constant risk of him painting over what might be some of his best work, but also how he is unwilling to remove his mistakes because they contribute so much to his rich layering. The portraiture that is included in the work that you might never notice, and how he deals with his self-doubt of if he's even a good painter and if the work is any good. We started by talking about John's years of sculpture and printmaking that eventually led him to painting.
I had this real sort of affinity to objects, and I'd find things and I'd pick them up and I'd think maybe they had secret powers or something, and I'd keep them. And if I bought a lottery ticket, I'd put this object on top of the lottery ticket, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I had this real love of objects, and I started making these sculptures that involved parts of my body or skin-related stuff that was sort of anthropomorphic-type works.
Were you casting, when you say parts of your body, were you casting things?
Well, I couldn't really do that. I think I'd moved to here. I was living, I had a little studio. We just had children and stuff, and I had a really small studio, and I couldn't do any of the real toxic stuff. So the only stuff I could work with was plaster, clay, and wax. So I'd made all these sculptures in there, and I'd been using plaster, clay, and stuff like that, because it was non-toxic, it was something that I could do, and it was something I could afford. And I was playing away with this for quite a long time, as you said.
Had you lost interest in painting, or was there never really approaching a painting practice?
I'd left AUT because, you know, and I had all this technology at my disposal, and I'd left there because, you know, they were doing a restructure. And I didn't have the computer printing machine. I didn't have the print room. I'd lost a whole lot of stuff. So I had a printing press. I had a few bits of material. And so I worked in this little studio making these weird objects that no one really liked. And I also was soaking paper in like a water-based or a sort of a really thin sort of color. And I would I'd soak the paper in it, and then I'd roll it through the press. And I did this so many times, probably hundreds of times. I'd roll it back and forth. I would drip like watercolor sort of paint. And I was trying to make this surface that was really skin-like, had a real skin quality. And I was trying to suggest it was like an object, but it was also a bit self-portrait, you know? Whereas it didn't show any image of me, but it was kind of my skin colour, I suppose. Mm. And I got really into trying to make the best skin colour. And putting the paper through the press probably 100 times, it would squeeze the paper out. It rusted my press quite badly because it was a lot of water everywhere. But it would create these beautiful patterns coming back through the other side of the paper. And then so when I actually finished them, it was the back side of the paper that I was actually showing, and I would frame them, and I framed a couple in like a gold sort of background. So they had a lot of religious icons to it as well. So while I was making these sculptures, that were quite anthropomorphic, but they were a little bit religious as well. And I didn't really want to intent it or suggest something too much. So I thought, you know, looking at the skin colour or looking at these other sort of parts was quite interesting.
So in that sense, printing, sculpture, something in between, was that a first exploration of painting in a way?
Well, you mean my current painting or...?
No, just beginning to
play with material. Well, no, I'd been doing a lot of painting before that, but this was a really sort of, well, it wasn't abstract, but it was, I'm not too sure what I was doing, you know, maybe I was just passing time. I mean, putting a bit of paper through a press over and over again for hours, I mean, maybe I was lost. The sculptures I was making, I thought they were really interesting. And I had made this, and I was currently working on a movie set myself for Spartacus. And the stuff that they would throw out in the bins and stuff was really interesting for me. So I would scurry around the bins and I was bringing a bit of stuff home because we made a lot of latex skin and a lot of sort of wounds and things like that. And I was quite interested in that. And I was bringing some stuff home and I made this work in the studio of a sort of a tree stump, and then I had this latex thing over it. And I called it John Wayne. I entered it into the Parr Homestead Award, and it won the Switzerland, can't remember what that prize was called. And I had that on the wall for probably half a year, thinking, man, there's something about this work that I really like. No one had seen it, but I just thought, oh, it's just, you know.
Did you figure out what it was you liked about it?
It was a really interesting contrast of materials and just the way it sat. It was just sort of a work that I sort of happened to make while I was making all these other works. And I put it away on the side and I just lived with it for quite a long time. But I always thought, wow, that's really, there's something really exciting about that.
You lived with it for a long time before you entered into
it? Well, it was just on my studio wall. And then a friend came into the studio and I was saying, listen, I think I might enter this into the wall. What do you think this is like? And he goes, well, what about this work over here? And I said, oh, yeah, I love that work. And he goes, why don't you put that in there? And I said, oh, I don't know. It's just, I don't know if it sits well with me, you know. But eventually I did, and obviously they liked it. It was a bit of a simulacrum about the, you know, it wasn't real, you know, but it looked really real. So it was an interesting work.
So it sounds like, if anything, sculpture was a way for you to be able to explore a ton of different stuff, like just playing around.
Yeah, because I was out of the institutional framework and I was on my own and I was going crazy. You know, that was work that I could make.
And with all that sculpture work, were you ever thinking cognizantly about how that applies to painting, or were you thinking, well, I'm a sculptor, like that is what the practice will
be? No, well, being a sculptor is quite difficult. You need a big space, you need to be quite strong, and you end up having a lot of things lying around, right? I made small sculptures for that purpose. I did make a big sculpture, which is stuck at work, and I don't know where I'll ever do with that. And then when we moved here, I moved here and 2013, after we'd come back from Switzerland from this residency thing that I won. And I was working away and I started making pottery type stuff out of wax that was very skin like. And I thought, man, I've just been overcome by the Hawke's Bay, because obviously it's a very pottery area. And I thought, what the hell am I doing? I'm making plates and I was stacking them. I just thought, what the hell am I doing? Anyway, I was hanging a show at the gallery where I was working, and there was a Liz Moore painting of Elizabeth, I think it was called, where she's holding a cigarette. And that was painted on this board called Masonite. And then I had a lot of this Masonite in the workshop that was quite old. It had stuff on it. And I was hanging this painting and I was thinking about, what the hell am I doing with my life? And I thought, shit, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make some small paintings that include my Greek heritage in some way, some of my other sort of history, traveling and sailing and things like that sort of stuff. I'm going to make some small frames, that four paintings that like that. I'm going to paint my sculptures in these paintings so they become important. And I'm going to do like a sort of a Graham Fletchery type thing.
So was that the first time? So date this for me. The first time you kind of start moving from sculpture to painting.
That would have been 2016, 2017.
Right, yeah.
And I thought, oh, I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to try and get into a gallery. Yeah. I never really tried to do that before.
Well, to step back to sculpture for a minute and bringing those into paintings, I'm assuming you're talking about, you mentioned before a large work, but I'm assuming you're talking about you'll hurt yourself and break something from 2014, quite a large format sculpture.
Was that big sort of, it looked like a pizza oven-y type thing?
Yes, you could describe it as a pizza.
Someone gave me a whole trailer full of Remu, and I wanted to build this two-dimensional structure, but I had such a big studio and a bit of time that it just got really out of control.
Well, it's huge, that work.
Yeah, it's really big. And it's a real shame because I wanted to put it in an outdoor sculpture park that was here, but I didn't really know what I was doing, and I hadn't finished it properly, so the weather here would have destroyed it.
Right.
So luckily I work at a gallery that's got big storage, so it's in there, and every time I hang out in someone's house, I think, is there room for the sculpture that I could bring out?
Well, it's funny because that's the work, like again, researching this and looking at what I could of yours, you know, that's the work that I looked at that and saw the shape of that work and the lines of all the different pieces of Remu, and a crossover between that sculpture and these white stripes or white and red stripes in different blocks that seem to start appearing in your painting around the same time. So it was at that time that you started transitioning from sculptor into some painting works.
I didn't really have a painting style that I was happy with. It was quite, my painting style in the past was quite flat. I was really into...
Well, it sounds like, to be fair, it sounds like painting before was just part of another process, part of screen printing, not specifically.
And I was really into artists like Matthew Ritchie and Franz Ackelman, and they were all densely layered works that had something to do with cartography, and they were quite colourful and things like that. So that was kind of my painting style before, and I thought, that's not really going to do it for me. So I spent probably 2 years from 2017, 2019, really redeveloping my painting practice. I started doing a lot of still lifes. I started getting back into drawing. I started painting still lifes. I started painting outdoor stuff, trees, landscapes.
Just anything you could paint for the sake of
and
figuring
I was
out.
Just, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I really wanted to get back and become a better painter. I wanted to be tonally better. I wanted to not apply so much paint. I wanted to have a bit of transparency going on. So I'd set a few things that I wanted to accomplish. I think I was looking at artists like early Hockney stuff. I really loved his work. Early stuff is, I don't like his work now, but the early stuff, I really liked how he divided up the composition. I really enjoyed his perspective and his foreshortening and stuff and creating distance in his work. I was a big fan of Julian Hooper's work.
So you spent what sounds like a couple of years just figuring out what painting might be for you.
Yeah, and just really redeveloping it. I just wanted to just get a bit better. I even started doing some tutorials online about how to paint a lemon and stuff, I think, at one stage. And that sort of stuff really taught me a lot of stuff. It kept me busy. And all through this time, I was building a sort of a research sort of a language of images and things like that.
How are you finding that transition from sculpture to painting? Like, quite tricky conceptually and with materials?
Oh, no, it was really good because I sort of gave myself a framework of making small paintings, and I'd use what I was...
Small because don't bite off too much, John.
Yeah, and I didn't have a big studio, and I just wanted to start out, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can get lost painting a big painting into sort of the grandness of the painting. And I used to think that doing a small painting was quite difficult, but it's actually a bit easier than a big painting, I think.
Especially if it's just a lemon.
But, it was a good lemon.
Yeah,
I bet. And, you know, I would grab branches outside and paint that and stuff and practice painting glass jars or something like that. You know, real basic stuff that I used to do at art school but never really enjoyed doing, so left it behind.
Were you enjoying it then?
I was loving it. And I was building, a good reference library. You know, I was just doing a whole lot of stuff that I didn't really know what I was going to use for, but I knew that I was building up a sort of repertoire of references. And then references
and painting ability. Yeah, like it sounds what you're talking about is your ability to be able to apply a bunch of different painting languages or just to expand your capability.
And I didn't know whether I wanted to use, I didn't want to use oil because I'd done so much printmaking in the past that I'd been surrounded by toxicity quite a lot. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really want to do oil. I really wanted to do acrylic. But I think before that I was using flash and sort of flat paints. And so I looked at, I use Matisse structural range. Maybe I went for that because it had structural range on it and I was coming from a sculptural background and I thought about pushing paint around rather than applying it. But then in the end, the Matisse range is really a good, you know, it's got a good pigment in it, it's archival, and it's got a good rating in the ASTM, which is the American Society for Testing Materials. So I looked at this stuff.
Scientific approach to.
Yeah, and I also, there was a conservator that was coming to the Hawke's Bay who was looking after the Peter McIntyre mural, and I became quite good friends with her because the gallery that I work at is next door to the library. Mm. And I was doing really thin washes on this Masonite board type stuff, which is what lots of artists used to use in the 70s. And it was, you know, big in the 20s, apparently. But then I think they changed the formula. And in the from the 80s on, there was some big court case where they had to do a payout or something. And then that material became quite, you know, it was quite used to rotting and deteriorating quite quickly.
Oh, right, okay.
But that's what lots of artists used to use in the past. So I spent a lot of time doing really thin washes on that and scratching it off and stuff. Because, you know, obviously if I'm going to make a work, I want it to last long and I want it to be archival and I want it to be appropriate. So I did a lot of tests there. I even talked to this conservator and I said, what do you think of this? You know, I'm using this on here. And then, so I sort of got I thought this was a great material because I didn't want to paint on board, but this was good. Lots of old artists had painted on it. So I thought it was good. And I remember when I worked at the Auckland Art Gallery that they were having a bit of a problem with that material, but I didn't have to do canvases and da da da. So I thought that was a good material to work on.
This is still research phase, like that,
yeah.
That period of like, I'm going to be, well, it sounds like you decided at a point you were like, I'm going to be a painter. I need to move away from sculpture.
Yeah. And I wanted to paint. I wanted to bring landscape into my work and I wanted to bring a bit more of my identity, New Zealand identity into my work because I thought that's what did well in this country, you know, which does do well in this country.
That's incredibly pragmatic as
well. It was. And I've never made a plan before and it worked perfectly. And I thought, shit, why didn't I make a plan when I was 20?
Yeah.
But obviously I wasn't ready for that. But, you know, and I also wanted to have an old school approach to my painting. I didn't want to make paintings about painting.
Well, it's funny, we're going to talk about that more, but increasingly looking at your practice now in terms of, you know, where it's evolved to in the last 5 or 6 years, it looks like you are making paintings about painting a lot more.
I know. I mean, you're constantly in this state of, if what I'm doing, is it good? Am I good at painting?
Yeah.
Is anyone going to see this? Constantly got artist turmoil about what I'm doing. But I think that's a real healthy thing.
Yeah.
And the process of painting.
Pretty common theme in these conversations, actually, no matter who the artist is, whether it's Graham Sidney or Robin White or, younger artists.
And I think you've got to love that process or else it's not going to last for you.
Love the process of constant doubt.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, when I started painting, I've got to you've got to have an idea what you're painting about. Mm. It doesn't mean that's what it's about, but you've got to start somewhere, right? So I have some sort of narrative in my head about what I want to talk about, but without telling the viewer what I'm painting, because I don't want to intend anything, and I want my painting to be a representation of something. But but anyway, I start it with quite a narrative in my head. And then I get into the process of painting, and then it's a to and throw for me in the work.
So that sounds like that period of, you know, 2016 through to 2018, where you're playing around with a bunch of different things.
That's right from then till now, you know.
But looking at work over the course of the last decade, you had a show in May of 2019 that seemed like a real turning point. And there was a mix of different styles on that show, but there was at least one work, a work called Little Red Hiding Head, which, listener, I'll include an image of that in the John Brown Good Oil Instagram post for you to have a look at. And that's where all of a sudden this quite cubist, geometric, but maybe cubist language seemed to appear. Yeah. And that work in one other, and they actually seemed like outliers in the rest of that show. I don't know if you remember. I do remember
those words, because, you know, I'd just spent a couple of years practicing what I was going to move into.
Yeah.
And that was what I had chosen was going to keep me excited, which it has until now. I was also incorporating some sort of collage in a few of those works.
Yeah.
Because I quite like the sort of contrast between stuff I was, you know, skin bits that I was cutting out of magazines, like on models and stuff, I would take an arm, but you wouldn't see the hands or anything. And I was sort of layering that up. So I suppose, you know, that was some early cubism stuff happening there, where I was sort of laying a model's arm like a couple of times and that. So I started doing a bit of that. And then I just thought, I'm at a stage now where I can actually paint that sort of stuff. And then I suppose the cubism sort of, I mean, I've always been interested in cubism. I mean, who hasn't? It's such a beautiful modernist medium. But I was really just breaking up the foreground and background mainly. You know, I wasn't like looking at cubism and trying to make it a cubit painting. But
well, I actually also wondered whether moving from a sculptural practice, obviously 3D by its very nature,
yeah,
into cubism as a language in painting was a bit of a no-brainer step for you, because, you know, if there is any claim to anything being 3D on a flat surface, it's cubism.
That's right, yeah. And I had a really three-dimensional drawing style as well, where I would draw, you know, I was quite heavy-handed. Like, I obviously copied my dad, and I was really heavy-handed, and I would produce a lot of lines to, you know, identify a surface or area.
Well, so was there a, you know, were you cognizant of moving from sculpture into a painting practice? I want to bring some of that 3D into a painting practice, therefore cubism is an approach for me to be able to take.
Yeah, and I also wanted to paint my sculptures that no one really liked and try and make them famous so I could sell them later, you know. But, yeah, I think the cubism just sort of evolved from breaking up the landscape. Obviously, lots of those paintings were sort of, I have got a Greek history, and I suppose when I was looking at sort of how could I bring that Greek history into the paintings.
Greek family history.
Yeah, you know, the paintings all presented sort of like a main figure, well, not a figure, but a main area in the middle of that painting that sort of was kind of like presenting something, you know. It was presenting a sort of something in the middle. So there was kind of a real sort of three-dimensional feel to those paintings, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know,
although you were talking about works that, you know, earlier than 2019 or around the same time, maybe, yeah, that were a lot more figurative than what we see now.
Yeah, they were. And I sort of dropped a bit of that figurative stuff.
Mm.
Because I've always been trying to introduce a bit more pattern to my work. I really would like to not overwork a painting too much, which I can't help. And I've always sort of thought, you know, this time I'm going to bring a lot more pattern into it. I think I was studying a bit of weaving and stuff, and I was reading a bit of stuff how certain weaves and formulate history and talk about, you know, sort of different areas in the weaving world. I don't know how to explain that.
Well, weaving in a sense, because I think, you know, weaving being quite geometric in a way, yeah, as well. So you mean that relationship between weaving, geometric, and cubism?
Yeah, and it also told a story as well, which I was quite interested in.
Oh, right.
So I sort of wanted to bring, I'd been developing a couple of shapes that had been resurfacing in a few paintings. I was trying to express a language, I suppose.
And that shape being, I'm still trying to figure out what this is, and I'm now looking around the studio to see if it is in any works. In fact, it is two or three as we sit in your studio. So, yeah, exactly. Whether that is a sail or...
Yeah, I think it references a few things. It references sort of a sail, a sort of a maybe a wing, a feather. It symbolises travel. It's also quite feminine at sometimes.
It is the element that, because it now features in, I've lost count of how many paintings.
Yeah, it has featured in a few paintings.
But it's almost like it's becoming a John Brown signature motif.
Yeah, and I've actually tried to do a painting of just that. And I think I have done a couple of them, but it sort of references quite a few things. And I think, you know, moving here from Auckland, it doesn't seem like much to some people, but for me it was quite a big relocation thing. So maybe it's got something to do with that.
Like, looking at it in your work, it's really interesting, and it's the piece that you said it's quite feminine, so maybe this is the by design, but it's also the piece that quite often will soften up what is the rest of it's quite cubist and it will soften up works.
Yeah, so, I suppose that's what I sort of mean by feminine. It does soften it up, and you know, some of them have been quite transparent, and some of them are quite solid. Yeah.
Subjects are quite often, especially now in the last few years, subjects are quite highly abstracted, but luckily for me, you're giving some guidance by, you know, kind of naming works. So Castle Point, Woolshed, Ruru, these are all works from the last 2 or 3 years. They all suggest a kind of regionalism. So, albeit one that's quite cleverly hidden in plain view, you know, with that cubist approach that you're taking. So do you mean to be a regionalist painter? Is it something you're chasing?
Well,
in the practice?
I don't know. Obviously, I've looked at a lot of New Zealand regionalist paintings in the past, mainly for the way how they've painted landscape and clouds and things like that. I don't consider myself a regionalist painting, but by doing landscapes, does that make you a regionalist painting?
Well, it's funny. It's more the things that you place in those landscapes that I think of. So, you know, again, Woolshed, for example, you're kind of making reference to these things, especially, I'm assuming, pulled out of the Hawke's Bay in a landscape that you live in.
I mean, I wasn't painting landscapes until I moved here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, landscapes are a big feature here, obviously.
Have they crept in simply because the landscape is far more present than it might have been living in Grey Lynn?
I think that I'm really influenced by my environment. I think when I was living in the city, as I said, I was painting quite intense, sort of intensely layered cartography type sort of works. When I moved down here, I sort of got rid of all technology and really was just sort of working with my environment. So it must have a massive effect on me. I don't mean to be a regionalist. Not that it's a bad thing. I mean, I've done a lot of paintings about Tomato Peak and things like that. And obviously I've picked up a lot of landscape stuff. I don't go out and draw the hills or wool sheds or something like that.
Well, are you, like, painting aside, are you spending, like, with the family, do you spend a lot more time maybe interacting with the landscape than you would have, say, in Grey Lynn? You know, it's more accessible here in the Hawke's Bay.
Yeah, well, I suppose in Grey Lynn I walked everywhere, so I was really urban, had a real urban feel to what was going on. And, you know, living where I do, you know, we do definitely see the landscapes. And I use the landscapes around me to learn how to paint a hill or something like that, you know, if I'm struggling. And clouds and stuff, I love trying to perfect a decent cloud. You know, I've got some pictures up here of Ian Scott and stuff like that, of some of his, Colin McCann's clouds, I love that sort of stuff. So sometimes I will go out, but, I mean, that's probably the closest I could be to, but obviously living in a landscape regional area and using that as a reference, as a source.
Well, you're a lot closer to it.
Yeah, it does make me a regionalist, although I'm not including specifically Hawke's Bay stuff. But I suppose it does creep in, doesn't it?
Yeah. And is landscape, because the works, landscape is really strong in the works, but it seems like a stage set.
Yeah, representation of a landscape. It's not an actual landscape. Sometimes I will use an actual landscape, but that's only because I'm struggling to paint the tonal areas of it. I mean,
but do they sit, because they seem like they sit, Now, don't get me wrong, the landscape painting is fantastic, but they seem like they sit in the background.
Yeah, they're like a backdrop, eh? And then I'm presenting this thing over the top of it. I think this people of the landscape is a really beautiful metaphor, and that's, you know, most of the stuff that I'm thinking, it's got to include the landscape and it's got to sort of come out of the landscape.
Even if it's just a stage set.
Yeah. And I suppose that's something that maybe has come from sculpture, where I'm sort of presenting a three-dimensional, I'm presenting something in a three-dimensional space, you know? So I think maybe that's sort of part of that sculptural days.
So then those elements that sit in like I'm drawing a distinction here, and maybe my reader's off, but I'm drawing a distinction, I guess, between stage set landscape that tends to sit in the background, and then these elements that that appear separate from that almost kind of hover in that landscape, and sit at the forefront, you know, in that stage set.
Yeah.
So are those the primary focus as subjects, those pieces that sit foreground rather than...
I really love for the viewer to have a race around the composition, and I really love this sort of background and foreground sort of layering. So I've been looking at these old artists, you know, I mentioned before Augustus Earle and, you know, even like William Hodges and Charles Heapley and stuff like that, where they did these landscapes, watercolours, and the background's always really faint and distant to project how vast the landscape is. I've really enjoyed looking at that lately, and I've sort of softened the landscapes off quite a lot. And I'm sort of trying to add a bit more distance into the painting, I suppose, and then bringing in some real small foreground stuff to sort of, you know...
But not to make the landscape secondary as such, even though it's...
just to create a bit of distance, mainly just for that. Give the viewer a sense that they can place something, but they're not sure what they're placing, you know? So
those elements, again, maybe cubist elements that do sit in the foreground, you're wanting to leave quite a lot of ambiguity in those for viewers?
Yeah, I mean... when I give them a title to a work, I see that as giving the viewer a sort of a doorway to walk in. I'm not telling you what it's about, but I'm giving you a sort of an idea that it's about. It's suggesting something, but I don't really want to intent or suggest too much in a painting. So
it's funny, right? Because if we use Woolshed, and again, I'll include an image of that on the Instagram post for your listener to have a look at. You know, I look at that and it's like, well, I can't see a bloody Woolshed.
No.
But
I can't really remember that painting, why it was called Woolshed, but, you know, obviously it was something I'd been reading.
You toy around with titles, you know, because clearly they're not representational paintings.
And there's
right?
a lot of portraiture in my work, I think, anyway. I mean, it might not look like it, but, I mean, in these paintings here, you know, I've included an eye in some of them, and then that I've never done before, and then that stopped that work because I'm trying to investigate whether that's too much. You know, am I suggesting too much by including a represented eye? So,
and by the way, for listener reference, we're sitting in John's studio in the Hawke's Bay and looking at work that I think will appear in a show in July at Melanie Roger.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, but it could be quite different by the time it gets here.
Yeah. You know. Well, I'm going to ask you a few process questions, but before we get to those, so I want to quiz you a bit more on cubist language that that you're using and seem to have settled on. So do you feel like you've comfortably settled on a cubist language for the works?
Well, I mean, you know,
is that too lazy of me? Maybe that's a lazy
question. No, it's not lazy. It's just, it's not like I'm purposely trying to make them cubist, but obviously modernist, but as I said, I'm trying to introduce a bit more pattern to it, a bit more repetition, because I'd quite like to take my painting in that direction. But because I find that quite a hard process to struggle with as I'm doing the painting, that I start overworking the composition a bit too much. And then I think through that overworking... and I don't get rid of my mistakes and stuff. I really like this layering. I think that really adds to it. So then it's creating a lot of depth and a lot of layers. And I think that starts adding a bit more to the cubist sort of feel, not intentionally, but I think when I do a painting and I do something and it's really shitty, I think, oh, I'm not worried about that because I'm just going to paint over it. But I'll include some aspects of it because I don't want to delete it entirely, and because I'm putting such minimal amount of paint and pigment on each work that it doesn't create this underlayer where you can see the lines and stuff. But if it does, that's just not a problem. You know, I think the cubist feel comes out of this layering and sort of fragmented ideas and stories and sort of breaking up the foreground and background.
I'm trying to figure out if you've made this next question redundant or not. Did you find a painting language, geometric cubist, and then subjects for it down here? Or has it been vice versa? You've found the subjects and then, you know, a cubist or geometric approach has been the best fit for those subjects.
When you say subjects, do you mean like what I'm painting about or
yeah, things yeah. like that? Although I wonder, you know, the way you're talking about the works at the moment, you know, it seems like there might not be necessarily firm subjects as such.
I was really into the Romantic era, and I really like looking at paintings from that era because, you know, my imagination's really feeds into that, what the artist is trying to portray. So I build up a massive narrative in my mind to start a painting, because otherwise I find it really hard to start something. Even though I'm not going to be, so say if I'm doing a painting about Shag Point and this industrial zone that started up or whatever, like I'll be thinking about how destructive that is on the environment and how that's impacted the people that live there and how that sort of developed and who these people have come over here and done that. And I'll think about all that sort of stuff. So that'll start the initial painting. Because I've done lots of drawings and stuff in my sketchbook, I've got a lot of reference material already that I can sort of incorporate in that. So I will use that to start a work, but then once I start the painting process, it sort of will, you know, evolve and change, and I'll edit, subtract, overlap, and all that sort of stuff. So it really stops being about that initial thing and starts being about the process of painting.
Right, I mean, so just a starting point.
Yeah, well, you've got to start somewhere, right? And I think with those early paintings, I was just layering washes on them like I was with this paper and the press in the other studio, and then I would build up these really deep and rich backgrounds, and then I would start working on top of them. I suppose it's like when you come into the studio and you don't really want to work, you start cleaning your brushes or you do some sweeping or something like that, you know. It's a good way to get you going.
Well, it sounds like then that the language that you've settled on is one that allows you to explore those ideas far more freely than maybe a figurative approach did 10
definitely.
Years ago.
And that's really important to me because I've made so many different works over my life that I really didn't, you know, I'll make something and then I'll be like, oh, I've done it. And then I'll move on to something else. And I really didn't want to do that. I really wanted to give something a good go and I wanted to really explore it. And what I had developed gives me so much freedom.
Well, that's something that I want to spend a while talking about, actually, because, and again, I mean this as a good thing. Looking at your practice, especially in the last 5 years, it's evolved at such a rapid clip, both, you know, palette, the language that you're using, how you're evolving that language. It almost feels like you're wrestling to some degree with some frustration around not yet being able to actually articulate what you want to with a painting language and the ideas you have. So is that right? Are you still getting closer to a language that you actually want to use to articulate ideas?
I think I'll always be exploring that. And I think that's a really good thing because it makes me really excited to come to the studio and work and stuff like that. I think with my palette and stuff, I focused on a set of colours quite early out, even though some of them are quite bright, some of them aren't.
Well, they were much brighter 2 or 3
That's
years
ago. That's
what
my partner keeps saying.
well, hang on. Have you not noticed that they've toned down quite a lot?
Yeah, I have. But I mean, before I was adding a lot more sort of sky and things like that.
You're tightening the frame up now.
I just thought maybe that's, you know, I can't, you know, I just sort of changing the composition a little bit, you know. It's not all blue skies.
And that's not all bright colours anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I sort of change as my mood goes. But, I mean, they're still very similar. And the colour palettes, you know, I'd say if you did a rainbow, you know, a colour wheel of my colour palette, it would all be sort of very similar colours. I thought it was a very sort of Hawke's Bay palette when I first moved here.
Yeah, quite. You mean the brighter works?
All of my palette, the ochres, the greens, the browns and things like that. I thought that, you know, the colours I had chosen, because I, you know, chose the colours, were very Hawke's Bay looking colours. And I wanted, you know, that goes back to the regionalism, I suppose. I wanted it to be Hawke's Bay colours without being Hawke's Bay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So but you must have noticed that you've really toned those down now. Like the Spinal Tap, you know, turn it up to 11.
Yeah.
You're kind of, you know, turning it down now to, I don't know, 2 or 3 or something.
Yeah, and I just did a series using a lot of gold. Yeah, I can't remember why I wanted to start doing gold paintings, but I wanted to start doing maybe the golden land or just maybe some sort of fallback from being religious. I don't know, but I was investigating some sort of gold works, and I thought they were quite bright.
Yeah, you're right, they were, and that was only 12 months ago. So.
Yeah, they're quite bright. And then what I've got going on in the studio at the moment is quite dark, and I noticed that, and I think that,
Well, is that a determination not to settle into one, you know, John Brown tone?
Well, I didn't want to be too sort of literal and have a sky and a land and a middle, you know? I wanted to mix it up a little bit. I wanted to make it a bit more abstract and a bit more pattern-based, I suppose. Mm. But although they're not pattern-based, you know? I don't know. It's very easy to overwork something. The good thing about when you use oils, even though I don't use oils, is that you can come back in and you can make that whole area disappear.
Yeah.
You know, with acrylic, you can't really do that. But, you know, I work on raw linen and I work on prime linen. On the raw linen works, I can make areas disappear because I only put quite a small amount of pigment on there, so I can actually rub quite a lot off. On the primed linen, it's a bit harder to do. You can sort of see the layers are quite thin, you know, so I'll work on it until I really get the composition well, and then I'll start adding a bit more into it, solid, you know, making it a bit more solid.
Well, back to some, you know, really specific process questions, and especially around how much the work has evolved in the last, as I say, probably, you know, 5 years especially. Have you put some, I don't know, processes or habits or steps in place to try and advance it quite quickly, or has it just happened quite organically?
I think I hate that word organic, but I think it has happened organically. And I think I've really learnt to enjoy the process of painting. Like I used to draw out what I'm going to work on. You know, I used to work it out compositionally and stuff like that. Now I quite like...
Did you feel like you used to be forcing it a bit then? It sounds like...
Well, no, I used to plan it out a lot more. And I used to... And I was quite rigid. I'm going to do this here, this is going to be here, and that there. Now
Wait,
I
is that why you hate the word organic? Because you're a planner?
Oh, I just never liked the word organic.
Okay.
But, you know, I've actually really enjoyed that tussle that you have with the work, trying to make it work. And I think that... You know, I think that's what really gets me coming back into the studio.
Well, that probably brings me to a quote of yours that I wanted to ask you a little more about. Yeah. Primarily, the paintings start informed by a source, and the imagery within each painting evolves through the process of making, adding, erasing, overpainting, and editing. So there's a lot to unpick in that. Mm. For a start, what is source material?
Well, I suppose, you know, source material for me would be, you know, I'm not a massive reader. I have been reading a bit of this and that about the history of certain areas. So that's probably a good source material for me. Reading the history of how things got started, what the land used to be.
Oh, so as you say, reading history as opposed to images. You're not looking at, say, images as source material.
Well, I'm a very narrative-based sort of person, you know, so I really like that, and I like to come up with my own sort of narrative about what I'm actually, you know, the images that I will put, you know, associate with what I'm reading is good for me. And then if I'm wanting to achieve something, yes, I'll go and look at images of what it is I'm trying to do. Let's say the pink and white terraces. I've always been into the pink and white terraces.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to do a painting of the pink and white terraces. And I loved all the paintings of old of the pink and white terraces. I loved the whole story about it. I've been to the sunken village. I think I did a series of work after I'd been to the sunken village. The covered upness sort of came from that a visit to the sunken village out right. in Rotorua. So that kind of source material is good for me. And then
you've just described a process that, yeah. that goes from something very literal. We yeah. can all, like, as soon as you say, you know, pink terraces,
yeah.
just about anyone, I think everyone listening to this immediately will have an idea of what we're talking about. But in terms of like where that goes to as a painting, it's an incredibly abstracted process. Yeah. It sounds like you filter it through a whole lot of different thought yeah. processes.
And I don't want to paint the pink and white terraces yeah, yeah, how yeah. they look like, because that's not what I'm into. I'm into sort of abstract representation. And I've done a lot of paintings of pink and white terraces, and I just can't do it. And I think there was a painting I did recently that I titled The Pink and White Terraces because it sort of referenced a couple of the curvature of the pools and the right. depth and stuff like that, and the layering, you know, sort of up the hill. And it was a very soft sort of painting of mine. It, you know, obviously it had pink and stuff in it, but that's not why. I mean, I do like pink, using pink as a colour. That would be like a source material. And then the whole idea of this mysterious place that's got taken away from us will start the imagination, you know? And then I'll start working on ideas of how I can produce that. And I might have a few goes of it because I'm not too sure how I want to display that.
Well, that probably brings us to your, you know, addition and subtraction. And it sounds like there's a lot of that goes on yeah. in a single work. So are you quite cognizant of what that process is going to be? Or is it just you have a feel for, you add something and then you're like, oh, it doesn't work. I need to, you know, paint over it, subtract it.
I think I've come to accept that that's a really important feature of my work, and it adds a lot of quality. I make sure that when I'm painting those sorts of things, I'm not layering heaps of paint on there. I think I've come to accept that that's a part of the work. So sometimes I might even come in and just do something really arbitrary and loose on the painting just to throw a bit of colour there, because I know later that maybe that orange that I painted on first will appear in just a tiny little spot. But because of the layering of the layers, it's, you know, really adds to the work.
Well, that probably brings us to another quote, or at least I'm lifting something from your Instagram that you'd written that I found really interesting, and actually the video that accompanies it. So the quote is, "When you start a painting with no informed ideas, it's a real roller coaster ride to the finish." Mm. And that accompanied a post, and listener, I would highly recommend you track this down. A video on John Brown's Instagram that was posted in December 2023. And the video makes that statement of yours seem like a complete understatement. The painting that you record in that video is completely, it's unrecognizable from the point you start to what that painting ends up being. You know, how much planning goes into that, and how much of it relies on intuition now? It sounds like intuition is something you're getting more comfortable with.
Yeah, and that's something that really excites me, what happens and the struggle to make that work. You know, I could be making a painting and there'll be one part in that painting that I love and I think it's the best part that I've ever done, but the rest of the painting's terrible. So I'll spend months trying to make this painting work because of this one little part. And then I'll come in and think, oh, this is ridiculous.
Like square peg round hole. You're like,
and then I'll just paint over the whole thing. It's like, I can't keep this one painting for this tiny little bit.
It doesn't sound like that's breaking your heart so much anymore. You accept that as part of the process.
Yeah, it's part of the process. And, you know, every night I come in here and then I'll take a photo of how that painting is. And then I'll spend the next day looking at that image. I'll come back in the next day and then it will change a little bit more. So I take a photo of everything I do every night. So I could make a lot of those videos, but I think some of them are a little bit too much. But
Well, is that the case then with quite a lot of paintings, that where they start are barely recognisable?
Some of them. Yeah, some of them could change quite a lot. Some of them might not change too much. I'll have that reference of what I've done and I'll be looking at that during the day. You know, I could be stuck on a painting for quite a long time.
And during the day, you mean away from the studio, completely different environment?
So if I'm at work or whatever, I'm constantly thinking about what I've done and where I'm going to go. Because I think that's artist turmoil. I think that's really important.
And you're looking at like this on your phone or?
Yeah, mainly on my phone I'll have that. Sometimes I'll actually print out that painting and paint on those prints. Sometimes I'll do some drawings on paper and stick them to the painting. as I said to you before, that I had to make this other stretcher because I would have ruined this other painting. So sometimes when I'm working on something and I can't finish it, I'll make up another stretcher and I'll start something new, because hopefully working through that painting will resolve what I need to on the other one. I
think so, quite paintings, a good work. Paintings might actually be, what, months in the making?
Like, Yeah. I never sort of work towards a show. I'm constantly working all the time. I like to feel like I'm ready constantly, and I like to have as much time as I can.
I often hear painters say, oh, I'm not entirely sure, you know, where a painting's going. You seem to take that to the extreme. Like, where,
Sometimes I really enjoy it. Sometimes I like to have a bit more planning out. It depends how far I am, what I want to represent, you know, in certain aspects. It's, say if I think of something really literally, then I can actually draw that out, and then I can actually just work on the canvas to the plan that I have.
And that will work. Sometimes.
Yeah, that will work, but I don't know if I get as much. I do get as much joy out of that because I'm still going through the painting process, but I'm actually finding it a lot more enjoyable to have a lot more struggle, I suppose.
Yeah, because you've talked about paintings being an ongoing battle sometimes, which made me think of that Mike Tyson quote, you know, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah.
Are the paintings punching you in the face every now and again?
Sometimes. It's like a relationship, you know. Sometimes you can be getting on really well. Sometimes you're not, you know. But that's just what happens to move to the next stage. I think I enjoy it, and I've got the time. If I didn't have the time, it might be another problem.
Is time one of the ways you mitigate that struggle, that battle?
Yeah, I think it is, because
you're quite happy to let paintings sit in your brain,
yeah,
on your phone and in your brain.
Yeah, and then I'll start a new one. So I have a lot going on at the same time. Sometimes I'll work on a painting until I get the composition that I really like, but maybe the colours, the depth, and sort of the details not there. But I'll be like, this composition's great, I'm going to leave it for a while, I'm going to work on something else, and then I'll come back to that later. Like, most of the work I do, I sort of work on that. And then, say, before I'm presenting it to an audience or something, I'll spend that last month or whatever finalising it. And that's when it really pops off, I think.
This might be going maybe backwards in the process, because I think of the elements I'm about to ask about are sitting in the background of paintings. But work, I think probably 2 or 3 years ago, frankly, when I really started taking notice of your practice, I noticed that some of the most delicate and strongest features were the thin washes that sit like almost in the background. They almost kind of hover in corners, you know, above that landscape. They're certainly not central subjects. How much time have you put into getting those washes right on the linens? Because they look too good to be accidental.
Yeah, I think that I've learned a bit of that from looking at Julian Hooper's work, actually, because some of his work has got some really nice thin washes.
Mm.
And as I said before, you know, I can spend a long time doing that and then end up painting over pretty much most of it, but just leaving a little bit there. And I think that has become quite an important part of my painting process, and actually the final bit of the painting, because it also creates a lot of depth.
Well, they're such subtle elements.
Yeah. And I really don't want to lay too much paint on the canvas. That's something I've learned. And my painting style sort of changed a lot, where I'm not so much painting, I'm sort of rubbing pigment into the surface.
So brushes only have a small part to play?
Well, my brushes, I don't know if you can see them, but they're all trashed. and I go through quite a lot of brushes. And obviously I do paint big areas. Yeah, I'm sort of, I don't know if I'm pushing the paint around, but you know, definitely my painting, how I apply the paint to the canvas has changed. It's definitely different from a raw canvas to a smooth primed linen.
Well, so many of them look raw. Like, again, if I think about those washes that we're talking about that sit subtly in the top left, top right-hand corner, you know, behind the landscape elements that we've talked about, and, you know, and behind those central subjects, for want of a better word, like, they seem to sit on unprimed or virtually unprimed supports.
Mm. They create a real sense of sensibility and sort of, I don't know, maybe a little bit of fragility as well.
Yeah.
It's not until the final the work is finished that I really appreciate how that sort of step has got me to where I've gotten. So I definitely know not to apply too much pigment to an area too soon. There's a couple of works in the studio where I have done that, and then I've spent months trying to get rid of it.
Well, because you feel like it's just too much material.
It's too much pigment. It's too much too soon.
It feels too weighty?
I think what I was doing, like, say, we're just looking at this big painting now, and I think for that one, I sort of thought, okay, I really want to include a lot of repetition of pattern, and I want to sort of talk about how the repetition can create some sort of language that adds to some sort of ode to some sort of narrative or something that I've read. So I laid it on too thick too soon, and then I've realised it's too much. So I've spent the rest of the time trying to soften that off.
So you're spending as much time subtracting as you are adding?
Not really, because I know that the subtracting is part of my painting process, so it's actually part of the work.
Mm.
It's abstract enough to not actually matter too much. And you said, like, the little bits, actually, that's what becomes quite nice. There's little areas in there that are really, really interesting.
Yeah. You
know? And I really like those little bits.
And are you cognizant of hiding those in plain view? Like, as I say, the more I've started taking notice of works in the last few years, it's the little elements of your work that are beginning to jump out at me. So
yeah, I think it's just sort of, it's semi-intentional, because I know that they're going to resurface it at another stage. But I will paint stuff on the painting. Before it's dry, I'll wipe it off. So I can sort of make that decision quite quickly.
Is that quite tricky with acrylics?
It is tricky, but that's why some of my brushes are really crappy, because I'll spend ages rubbing it off.
Right.
And because it's really thin pigment on the canvas, in the linen there, it's easy to come off. Where some bits are, some bits aren't. But then some of the bits that can't rub off create a nice sort of rubbing area.
Well, it's that softening of a you know, cubist approach, which almost has you finding this language that's really working for you.
Yeah, I definitely think it is. And then, you know, so if I do something that I think, oh, that's just not going to work, I'll be like, just leave it. We'll work with that, and we'll, you know,
leave it, walk away from it, come back to it.
Yeah, definitely walk away with it. But I'm constantly thinking, shit, do I know what I'm doing? Is it working? Am I a painter? You know, is anyone going to like, you know, I'm constantly going through the struggle. And then, you know, as I said to you before, I was quite down on what I was doing the other day, but I just left the studio, because you've got to be nice to yourself, because once you start ripping yourself apart,
well, that's
very
interesting.
Hard to get back in here.
That's an interesting part of the process, maybe. You've talked about subtraction in terms of removing material from the canvas, but absence, subtraction, you're subtracting yourself, or absence from the studio, that's just as an important part of the practice as anything else.
But I might be walking the dog and looking at that painting on my phone thinking, Jesus, look at this thing, you know? So it never falls far away from me.
Right, you're not in the studio, but you're still with the painting.
Yeah, I am. I'm always thinking about what I've done.
Yeah.
And then, you know, sometimes I'll be in the studio thinking, wow, that's the best thing I've ever done. And I'll sit there for ages thinking, man, that's just genius.
Those ones survive?
No, I'll come back and I'll paint over it in another mood, you know? It's just like, you know, I've got to be really careful, because I've got to make sure I've got a lot going on, or else I could paint over something really good.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Constantly turning to another painting.
Yeah, so I've got to be careful, and I've got to make sure that, you know, I'm not acting irrationally.
I wanted to ask about what appear to me to be some traditional Māori art motifs that appear in some works. And again, maybe I'm getting this read wrong, but for example, a few specific paintings for reference sake: Wetlands, Convergent Boundary, Sunset Peak. I feel like I've seen like a tiki reference in those. And then Ruru and Sunken Village, the suggestion of the three fingers associated with Māori Manaia, you know, the spiritual figures. Mm. And Shag Point, a painting that we've spoken about a bit. I feel like there's koru elements in that. So is that a deliberate inclusion of Māori motif? And if so, why? Or is it more subconscious, or am I just getting the reading totally wrong?
No, it's definitely some reference to that. I mean, how can you be a painter in New Zealand and not reference stuff like that? I'm not Māori. I don't think I can make Māori art. I never would. I call that riding the cultural bus. I would never do that. But, yeah, I mean, it's like regionalism, really, isn't it? I mean, how can I avoid it?
It's a broader cultural context you exist in. It'd be foolish to try and not.
Yeah, exactly. This is where I live. There's a whole lot of Po that are outside the gallery. There's like 19 Po that all reference the area where they're from.
And just for reference here, listener aside, John works at the Hastings Art Gallery. Yeah. So you're walking through those Po
all
every
time.
Single day.
Yeah, and that carving and that's a source of material for me as well.
Mm.
And when I'm using that, I'm not ripping off that sort of stuff, but I've got a reference where I live.
Yeah.
I've got a reference the people. I love the way that Māori people reference the land and talk about it as part of them, where us whiteys just work out how we can make money off the land. I love all that sort of metaphoric sort of stuff, and, you know, that's a source for me as well. But I would never start doing some sort of Māori-inspired art. And, you know, the tickies and stuff, I've noticed some of that stuff as well. But if it was...
Well, you say noticed, almost like it's come out of your subconscious onto...
Well, I mean, I do have a lot of Po-type structures in my work, like these sorts of things and things like that. I mean...
Again, you're walking through them every day.
It's... Yeah, there's lots of kaitiaki sort of stuff of the environment.
Yeah.
And if I think about the arrival of the Europeans and what it must have been like for the people that lived here and stuff like that, and I think about that sort of notion of things, I mean, it's hard not to creep in there. But as I said, I'm not Māori, so I don't want to start doing Māori art.
Yeah.
And I don't know if non-Māori can do Māori art, but that's another discussion. But...
Well, also wanted to ask about maybe some other influences, because, you know, going down a few rabbit holes as I do when I'm researching this, came across a few works that just kept echoing, or maybe I thought, you know, are your works echoing them? So one guy in particular, I keep thinking about Brent Wong paintings and your paintings. There is a parallel of these strange objects kind of hovering in space over landscapes. So, are you wanting to reference?
I love Brent Wong. I really love his work. I love that sort of sci-fi sort of nature of these sort of Greek columns, sort of structures floating over an empty landscape. And I'd love to be able to paint like him. I went to a show that he had at out there in West Auckland there at that gallery out there. It's a public gallery where they have lots of studios and stuff.
At Corbin's Estate.
Corbin's Estate, yeah. And he had a show there in the gallery, and they were his bad paintings, because he had since stopped painting and gone back to composing. And he had some works out there that he said were his rejects or something. They were so beautiful. I love his clouds.
They're phenomenal paintings, aren't they?
And just standing in the gallery when I was young, looking at those, you know, obviously when I'm not young, but when I was at university, just looking at those and just thinking, wow, what's going on here?
You know? It feels like your works are a really wonderful
I'd love the works to be like his. But, yeah, it's just that fascination of the unknown and the sort of, what's he talking about?
And do you also feel like you're adding to a New Zealand history of cubism? So John Weeks, maybe Louise Henderson.
Yeah.
There's even actually a few Lois A. White paintings that I looked at and thought,
Yeah, well, I mean, I've loved all those painters. Louise Henderson, love her work.
And do you think they just quietly creep in without maybe you realise?
When I look at Louise Henderson's work, I sort of think, man, I wish I could paint as soft as her and get that feel of the work. And I'll probably start a painting with that notion of trying to be like that, but I just can't do it. It's just not in my nature to just be able to apply that paint with that ease. It will take me a long time to be able to have that ease come across.
Well, just as well. I mean, you want to be conducting your own practice.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't help but you can't, you know, engage in painting without thinking of the stage and who's on the stage and stuff like that.
Mm.
You know, I try not to look at too many other artists when I'm, you know, when I've actually got what I'm doing, I can look at people, but I don't want to look at too many people at once because I don't want their practice to start influencing mine.
Yeah.
Even though it's hard to be original, I'm trying to be as original as I can. I mean, there's so many painters that I love. But I definitely will reference those artists and look at those artists for some sort of reference to landscape. I mean, Rita Angus, there's such a representation, abstract feel to a lot of her paintings that I really love. I love her sort of cloud play and how she sort of works that.
I ask that question, I guess, around, you know, references to other New Zealand artists, because I feel like you're conducting such a New Zealand practice. You know, the work somehow exudes New Zealand landscape and New Zealand subjects.
I want them to look sort of New Zealand historical, even though they're not dealing with historical context in the literary.
They're not that specific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I definitely want them to look like maybe they've been around for a while, they're historical. You know, because I do read a lot of stuff about areas, and then, you know, when you ask me about these areas, Shag Point or something like that. So I suppose because I'm looking at this historical references of these places, that does creep into the painting.
They're history paintings as much as anything else. Question.
Yeah, definite big question mark on that. Yeah, I suppose they are, but without really being too history-ish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because obviously no one's going to know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do a lot of writing and stuff on the back of the paintings because installing art over the time that I have, I mean, so many artists do that. And it's such a buzz for an installer or the owner to see that.
Is that a habit? Will you write quite a long... Because I've been shown these before, and there's quite a long narrative on the backs of works. And by the way, listener, a note to you, you should go and hassle Melanie Roger and ask her to take works off the wall for John's next show to see if there are these long narratives, because they're pretty entertaining.
Well, yeah, and I suppose... I sort of think that's a little treat for the person who buys it or the person that sees it. Because there's so, you know, all the art installers always wanted to put out a coffee book of the painting. Like Salvador Dali writes novels on the back of his work, even though I can't read that. But, you know, lots of people do it. I sort of put it on the back because I want to give it some sort of context. And also for me to remember what I was thinking about when I was doing it.
Are there contexts usually of what the work is?
Well, it might be something that I've, a book that I've got on my desk that I've sort of read and sort of thought, oh, that's quite interesting. I might just rewrite that paragraph on the back. I'll reference it like a master's student or something like that. So I'm not plagiarizing anyone. But I think that's quite interesting. I mean, Ari does it on his works. He does like a whole nother painting on the
Ari Hellendel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does a whole nother painting on the back of his work.
Yeah. You are getting good bang for buck with Ari's works.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's quite interesting. I think that the painting that, you know, Rene Magritte did, the self-portrait that was a double image, and it's got a self-portrait of him and another portrait of his wife on the back. I think that was in the 70s or something. And that's a beautiful painting. I mean, if you look at the 1920s, that was. Yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful painting.
Well, look, this is probably a good point, especially talking about some of those other painters. Question that I ask everyone, last question. Removing any limited budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work would you, or artist work, would you love to live with?
I went for Three Figures and a Portrait, 1975, by Francis Bacon. I chose that painting because he's a real painter. He's a real painter's artist painter. His studio is a complete pigsty. There's so much stuff going on. I love the way that he talks about his work. I think I just heard something on Instagram the other day how he was talking about how he was working on this painting for months and then he just came out and painted all over it, which is exactly what I do. And there's so much in that painting. There's your central figures, there's a portrait. He's just done a lot of great portraits. And there's a lot in there that goes back to my sculptural days, that sort of grotesque sort of skin. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of sort of central activity set in a sort of a scene with a portrait on the back, and I just love his colour palette, you know. So I thought that would be a great painting to have. That would be something I could look at for quite a long time.
As always, thank you for listening. If you are interested in available work of John's or finding out more about his practice, please contact Melanie Roger Gallery in Tamaki Makaurau. Please join me for the next episode of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.